The United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit is now in session. Please be seated.
Good morning, everyone. We'll start the argument calendar this morning with Havens versus Kiljaji. When you're ready, counsel.
All right, thank you, Your Honors. Please the court. My name is Chad Hatfield. I represent Mr. Stephen Havens, the appellant in this matter. I would like to start on the issue of where this case and the review should start, namely at the alleged onset date. I think the first place to note is that this was not the first decision by an ALJ. A prior ALJ decision was made that did not discuss the opinion of Dr. Stringer and did not fully account for the electrodiagnostic imaging in the past. The Appeals Council issued an order instructing the ALJ to discuss the opinion, not given by name, but the Dr. Stringer's opinion that was not addressed, which was authored just 6 weeks prior to the filing date, and also expressed concern that that some of the sources did not have the electrodiagnostic testing for carpal tunnel syndrome, namely the state agency sources, and that could affect the outcome of the decision. As we see in this claim, the ALJ decision at issue now, that the ALJ took the direct opposite approach. The ALJ chose to truncate the record as a whole and did not follow the AC's order to pose a hypothetical question that reflects the specific capacity limitations established by the record as a whole. I would like to start with Dr. Stringer. This opinion was authored, again, less than 2 months prior to the protective filing date. The only reason offered by the ALJ for giving this no weight was that it was prior to the protective filing date. And in this situation, there's been some disagreement, and the federal district court seemed to support contentions that anything before the alleged onset date is of little relevance. However, this was not prior to alleged onset date, but simply the protective filing date. The Code of Federal Regulations indicates that the agency will develop a complete medical history of a claimant for at least the 12 months preceding the month in which you file an application, unless the claimant asserts the disability began less than 12 months prior to filing. That's 20 CFR 416.912B. The importance of that is that
Mr. Hatfield, I'd like to ask you a question about this, because it seems that I had a hard time figuring out when the real onset date is that's relevant for our consideration. In the application date and briefs, there's an allegation it's June 1st, 1995. In the hearing before the ALJ in 2016, your client counsel represented that the onset date was January 6, 2012, which I believe is the filing date. There's some evidence in the record that 2009 might be an onset date as well. What is your position as to the appropriate onset date?
The appropriate onset date, Your Honor, remains 1995. There was no amendment of the onset date. There was only the recognition that the protective filing date and benefits could be made payable only to the protective filing date. Now, again, that raises the question, and it was not a new issue raised on the reply brief, as maybe pointed out, was that even the protective filing date is not really clear in this case, as Mr. Havens did assert an alleged onset date prior to the previous application, and therefore is an implied request for reopening, and Dr. Stringer's opinion would be new and material evidence submitted within 2 years and be for reopening. That was just to say, if it was the protective filing date, even Dr. Stringer's opinion would not necessarily be kept out of that. But of course, it is the alleged onset date, for we know that just as a practical matter, is often the medical opinions, directions, objective medical evidence that comes in that prompts an individual to apply for Social Security disability. That's why the regulations require an updating of the medical records.
Your answer is less than clear, at least I understand. What is the period of time that you want us to consider the medical evidence in this case?
Well, I think as discussed at the hearing, the evidence from 2000...
Just tell us, what period of time should the ALJ have looked back to in evaluating Mr. Haven's condition? From when to when?
At least back to 2009, as noted at the hearing, say this is when the objective evidence was supportive of it.
Is that permissible? Is that permissible, given that the prior applications were denied? Were the prior decisions reopened?
Yeah, the prior decisions could be reopened. The only decisions was an ALJ dismissal, which is not a decision on the merits. And the other claims were reopenable through new and material evidence, which we have for Dr. Stringer. There are no constraints for the ALJ going back and considering the time period back to 1995 or 2009 when we had the objective electrodiagnostic evidence.
So is your view, is it your position that from 1995 until the date of his application, that's the period of time?
Yes, Your Honors. And of course, there are some practical concerns here. I know that it may seem, we'll just state the day. Of course, if we say, if Mr. Haven says, okay, I didn't go to the doctor and get testing until 2009, but I've been disabled since 95, the judge will raise the concern, hey, you didn't work for the years from 95 to 09. I can use that as a factor against your credibility. So Mr. Havens does need to assert alleged onset date for when he felt his conditions kept him from being able to work full time.
And when is that? When is that?
1995.
Okay. So what is your argument? That it's a legal error by the ALJ for failing to consider all the past medical evidence?
Right. Yes, and particularly Dr. Stringer's opinion. The Appeals Council even ordered that opinion to be considered and weighed just weeks prior to the effective filing date, clearly at issue. It was an opinion that was stated the condition was deteriorating, but lasted at least 12 months. And yet the ALJ, again, gave no reason other than just stating it was before the protective filing date. That is an error in itself, as that's potentially dispositive opinion. And also that opinion supports the later opinion of the treating source, nurse Joseph Poston, who had given the opinion for sedentary work with a need to miss days due to pain. In that opinion, again, the ALJ didn't consider the opinion of Dr. Stringer, even some of the 2009 opinions by other sources giving similar opinions in their decisions. The ALJ seems to focus on, for reasons, Dr. O'Para, which is noteworthy that the ALJ had said in the prior ALJ said, found that given that little weight due to Dr. O'Para not having electrodiagnostic evidence and Dr. O'Para not really considering all the impairments. With further evidence, which came in afterwards, which Nurse Poston had cited, new x-rays showing significant stenosis and exam findings, now straight leg raising, that there was a deterioration as opined by Dr. Stringer. So it adds up to where that this was legal error, as a judge cut out so much of the relevant evidence by simply conflating the protective filing date and the alleged onset date.
Okay. Did you want to save the rest of your time?
Yes, I'll concede the rest of my time. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Diana Ansager on behalf of the commissioner and asking this court to affirm the district court's decision that the ALJ's decision is supported by substantial evidence and free of legal error. At the outset, I would like to clarify something. The ALJ did not discount Dr. Stringer's opinion, nor Nurse Segrin's, nor PAC Thompson's opinion, simply because they were too remote. If you look at page 24 of the ALJ's decision, if you don't mind indulging me, at the second full paragraph at the bottom of that page, the ALJ writes, it does state that one of the reasons they are not relevant is because they are too remote, but it also states that these are not consistent with the evidence that documents few findings. Now, the citations that the ALJ has for this is B7F 1 through 4 and B7F 9 through 12. That is Nurse Poston and PAC Thomason. And 13F is Dr. Stringer. So it is accurate to say that the ALJ addressed all of these opinions and gave valid reasons for discounting them.
What is your position as to the alleged onset date in this case?
In terms of the reopening or in terms of what the ALJ should have looked at?
Either one.
Okay. So under the regulations, the ALJ is required to look at... Oh, excuse me, let me back up for a second. So Havens would be entitled to benefits only from January 2012 forward. However, under the regulations, it's true that the ALJ has to look back at least 12 months. So the ALJ has an obligation to look back until, say, January 2011, and some discretion to look back at the earlier evidence. But according to page 24, the ALJ did actually look at all the evidence, but considered whether or not Havens was entitled to benefits after 2012. So I think there is some ambiguity, certainly with the hearing testimony that Your Honor mentioned, and the ALJ's decision about what exactly is the alleged onset date. But it really doesn't matter because the ALJ did consider all of the evidence going back to 2009. Now, I'd like to add, this case turns on a fairly sparse treatment record with minimal findings and multiple conflicting opinions from treating nurses, physician's assistants, and consultative examinations. So, in light of this bare record and the multiple conflicting sources...
Can I interrupt you just a second?
Sure.
So let's go back to that statement that you pointed us to. So mm-hmm. These reports are too remote in time and are not consistent with the evidence that documents few findings. What is the ALJ talking about?
This is a conclusion paragraph. The ALJ is referencing all of the medical evidence that precedes this. The mild to moderate findings, the mildly reduced range of motion, particularly the ALJ is relying on the substantial evidence of Dr. Opara's examination. Dr. Opara was a consultative examiner.
Just a minute, counsel.
No, I was just going to say that the sentence, though, as I read it, is rather ambiguous.
I don't agree that it's ambiguous because it refers to the preceding discussion, which is quite clear and repeatedly mentions that there are few objective findings, there are few treatment records. Instead of having the ALJ repeat all of the evidence there, it is, I think we can infer that this is referring to the prior paragraphs. Under Lambert, the ALJ does not have to reiterate everything, does not have to write a dissertation. This is a summary paragraph discussing how the objective and medical findings and treatment records do not support Haven's allegations, and they definitely do not support the opinions.
Okay.
So if I could go back to Dr. Opara for a minute, I just want to point out that Dr. Opara is substantial evidence in support of the ALJ's decision. Under Tanapedian, Dr. Opara, who is a physician, he did a consultative examination in 2012, a few short months after Dr. Stringer's opinion, and he found no limitations. Now, this is really notable. He was aware of all of Haven's alleged impairments. He did extensive testing. He found very few limitations. He found no limitations, actually. He had a negative Phalen's, a negative Tinel's, and a normal range of motion, a normal gait, and intact sensation. So I don't want to belabor his points because they're all in the record, but I do want to point out that the ALJ, given the extensiveness of this examination and the fact that it was within the time period, reasonably relied on this. Dr. Opara made his own independent findings, and he was a physician, and as I stated, under Tanapedian, this equates to substantial evidence. Now, there's a lot of evidence in this case, and it's a lot of it is conflicting, but some of the evidence is very far outside the period from 2009 and directly contradicted by Dr. Opara. Other evidence is closer in time, such as Dr. Stringer's, but it is also inconsistent with not only Dr. Opara's examination, but the many, many mild findings within the record. I'm happy to go into more of that if the court wants, but I know you're familiar with the record.
Does the record show whether Dr. Stringer examined Havens for the November 2011 opinion? I see a reference to report from records, and it wasn't clear whether he was the examining doctor for purposes of that opinion.
Judge, that's actually a great point. It is ambiguous. It looks to be, that record appears to be a mix of, it does have some findings such as blood pressure, which suggests she did examine him, but it also says that she reviewed the report from records. So I think it is unclear whether she examined him or not, but she certainly did not do the extensive examination that Dr. Opara did and Dr. Opara documented in the record. Now, if I could address the terms of the reopening issue, I do want to point out that there's no indication that when he submitted Dr. Stringer's opinion, it was an implied request for a reopening. There's simply no indication of that. There's no indication he submitted it within 12 months. And not only that, but given that Dr. Stringer's opinion was in 2011, it is entirely immaterial to the prior decision, which the period ended in 2012. So really, there's no standard under which Dr. Stringer's opinion would constitute a valid reopening. Now, it's interesting that with the ambiguity about the onset date, under Social Security HALEX, an earlier onset date can be an implied request for reopening. However, there's really no indication that he meant this here. And in fact, at the hearing, as Judge Pius pointed out, it contradicts that. In fact, suggests he was alleging 2012 as the onset date. So we can hardly fault the ALJ for not considering this an implied request to reopen. And in any event, it is pretty immaterial because, as I said, the ALJ did consider evidence going far back to, say, 2009. He didn't consider evidence going back to 1995 because that's really not in this record. I could just consult my notes here. And on appellant's point about the appeals counsel, the ALJ did everything that appeals counsel instructed. It considered carpal tunnel syndrome to be severe, but found that it was not because there was absolutely no treatment for it after 2010. And this is a valid reason to find an impairment not severe. I also want to point out that although the ALJ gave Dr. Opara's examination and opinion weight, he also credited some of Haven's complaints. So Dr. Opara had found that Haven's had no limitations. And the ALJ says in the decision, I'm going to credit some of his complaints due to pain disorder. And then he added on restrictions that are consistent with some of Haven's complaints and with some of the opinions of the treating sources that he discounted, such as postural limitations for Haven's neck or reaching, a manipulative limitation. And of course, an exertional limitation to light work. So given all that, the ALJ is really giving Havens the benefit of the doubt. He's looking backwards. He's evaluating everything and its consistency with the later evidence, which is minimal, and still giving him some limitations to accommodate, to inform the RFC. Sorry. If there are no further questions, I would ask the court to affirm the ALJ's decision, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
In response to the reliance on Dr. Parr's opinion, it is important for the court to review only those reasons offered by the ALJ. The ALJ found that the finding of Dr. Parr of normal wrist joint and finger joints to be inconsistent with Dr. Haven's complaints of numbness and tingling of his fingers. This is where it is the Ninth Circuit has often asked the ALJs to resist the temptation to play doctor, as wrist joints and finger joints are not related to the carpal tunnel syndrome. The gold standard for testing that is electrodiagnostic testing of carpal tunnel syndrome, which was on the record. And this was given as an advisement by the appeals counsel, and the ALJ ignored it and was off. Another thing to point to is the weight given to the statements of Mr. Havens. It's very important that the ALJ, the reason she gave, and it was cited by the commissioner over five times, is the ALJ said Mr. Havens had he testified to an inability to pick up things and cited the transcript page 6061. If we look at that record, Mr. Havens said that he has problems with his hands when he does too much or for things for too long. The ALJ authored an inconsistent statement that's been repeated through the record and uses a reason to discount his allegations. The same as mowing the lawn, doing laundry and such, as he testified that 10, 15 minutes he has to take a break. He has help. His father helps him, finishes the lawn mowing, does the laundry for him. And so the ALJ missed the entire point, is that he is talking about when doing things on a consistent, ongoing basis, repetitive activity, he's not able to endure those things. That was on the basis of his disability. Those things are not well found by a consultative examination of a few minutes, and certainly not by the findings that the ALJ found. So the opinion of Dr. Stringer offers 6 weeks before, regardless of reopening, which it is found to be new and material, is an appropriate basis with 2 years of the initial denial of the prior application. So for those reasons, it is highly critical of this case. It is material. It is harmful error, as it would change to the judge's RFC, and it further supports the disabling opinion of Nurse Poston. And for those reasons, Mr. Havens requests a remand in his claim.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel, for both sides for your argument. The matter is submitted. The next case is